Well, welcome again to the Anything's Possible podcast, where we say everyone has a story to tell and a step to take, and with Jesus, anything is possible. Today on the podcast is a good friend of mine by the name of Matt Spalmone. Matt is actually a pastor here in the area, Church of the City, East Nashville. But we have an interesting friendship, interesting story. Pastor Kevin talked to us last week at Cross Point about forgiveness. And Matt and I go into our story where he offered forgiveness in a season where I did some damage. I hurt him, and it gets real. So you guys want to listen to the end, because there's just some really amazing content that Matt gives. And as always, if you got questions that pop up on this, you can email us at anythingspossible@crosspoint.tv. But I want to jump into this conversation with Matt Spalmone. Welcome to the Anything's Possible podcast. Man, I'm here with my good buddy, Matt Spalmone. I've actually been a little more nervous about this podcast than any other one we've done so far. Have you been on a podcast before? I'm sure you're
No, this is the first thing I've ever done like this. No, I'm serious.
I don't know why I've been nervous. I know why I'm nervous. I'm nervous a little bit because of what we're going to talk about later. But also because of the closeness of our relationship, I feel like there's just things that you can completely out me on as well. Like, you're just going to call me out.
You know, you usually lie on the podcast.
Well, I don't make, see, exactly, just prove my point. I don't make a habit of lying, but yeah.
My concern is, we know each other so well, none of this is going to make sense to anybody because we know all of the backstory.
It'll just be inside. Okay. Well, we've got great producers in the room that'll help us
get
all that. But I am excited to talk about just kind of our story, what you're doing right now. And let's start there. You're a lead pastor over at Church of the City in East Nashville. Talk a little bit about what God's doing at Church of the City. I love this church.
Yeah, so I guess we're like 2 minutes from here.
Yeah.
Meeting in East Nashville High School. Our church is just 7 years old, and I'm 5 years into the story. We're not as easy to find as we once were, which is great.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think early on, we were, you know, indie rockers in our 20s who'd, you know, vape and blog, you know, and that was kind of
that was your church.
Yeah, it was our diversity. Yeah, I mean, we were who East Nashville was even, you know, 5 years ago. So it's a rapidly changing neighborhood, as you know, lots of challenges. Mm-hmm. We try to be thoughtful in how we engage with, you know, gentrification. The truth is, right now, East Nashville has a lot of great stories going on, but there's also a ton of gun crime and heroin that we're dealing with. And so we just try and engage thoughtfully with that, have a heart for at-risk kids. And I love this church. My dad was a pastor, and I never really wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised. I always felt in life you have to choose between fun and meaning. And as a seven, I've always chosen fun. And it's a real surprise to me that
you can have both.
You can have both. Yeah. And I'm really surprised that you can have that as a pastor.
Yeah.
I thought it was like phoning in, like,
right.
Fun life as we knew it would
be. Well, and I love seeing you in this role. Yeah, I think the way that you pastor that community, I've told you this before, I love watching how you pastor our city in that area of city. I can tell you really love that community. You love those people. Also, a brilliant communicator, which I listen to just about all of your sermons, all your podcasts. It's so good. The stuff you're teaching is amazing. We'll link to it as well, because I want people to get some.
That actually makes me extra nervous.
Yeah, when your friends listen?
Yeah, when you walk into church sometimes.
Oh,
and I love it.
You've come to 5:30 services before. I know exactly. I could walk right now to the auditorium and tell you where you were sitting when you're there. I'm more nervous when you're in the room.
What does that say about us?
I don't know. I don't know. I think it does matter to me. The people I'm closest to, it's true for my wife too. Are you with Mary? If Mary, like, you get done with the message, if she cares about what you talked about?
I mean, our wives are both equally nice.
They're amazing people.
Yeah. I don't know. I think maybe I feel, I think it's different. When you walk in, I don't feel it's like it's when my wife's there. I feel like it's a brother. You're a brother that I kind of want to impress in some deep down broken
spot. And we have a competitive, a friendly competitive thing too, where, like, I really feel out of anybody I know, I would say you want me to win about as much as anyone. Like, you're biased in my favor. But also, we're personally, whether we're playing basketball or ping pong or whatever it is, we're pretty competitive too.
Right.
So if you deliver a great message, there's a part of me that's like, oh man, Smalls just crushed that. I gotta up my game.
I don't usually lose ping pong to Americans. And it happened one time.
I've only beat you in front of people.
Yes.
You beat me
that,
always.
I mean, that is who you are. You pull out the big guns when the crowd is there.
What does that mean? That is who you are. Yeah, I don't know. Perform well under pressure or something. But there's been several
clutch
moments where I've...
Clutch pal.
Exactly. I've beat you in very important moments in my life, and I can remember them. You beat me all the rest of the time. So what are you seeing God do? I can't tell you how many times I've been in one of our lobbies, and I've recommended your church to people, which I think is interesting. I think it speaks to who you are. It speaks to what God is doing in our city. I really love Church of the City. It's a great church. I've got a lot of friends there. It's almost like a reverse negative sale because people look at me when I recommend another church as like, what? And then they end up staying. Yeah. So it's part of my strategy. But no, I'm just kidding. So what are you seeing God doing in our city and in your church?
I think for us, the specific age of our congregation, a lot of my guys are in deconstruction. So, you know, Australia was not like America. You only went to church because you believed in Jesus. Mm-hmm. And there was no kind of shame if you didn't. You know, I heard recently 5% of Australians go to church. I'm not sure if that's true.
But so culturally it wasn't a thing?
No, it wasn't really a thing. And so what's interesting to me is Australians never really deconstructed, which is what's happening now. Because to deconstruct, you have to have constructed some idea of who God is. And in Australia, very few people actually did that work. So what's interesting to me is I have a congregation of people who've been going to church for decades who are now coming across difficult portions of Scripture, or life is just getting big on them. And the image of God, of who they thought God was and God, what God could do is changing. And so they're deconstructing and they're hanging on to faith.
That's hard work as a pastor and
for dear life.
Too.
Yeah, yeah. And I care deeply. I deconstructed massively back when I was in a band, and it was hard and it was lonely. So I care deeply about our guys actually being able to trust Scripture. I'm learning. You know, I've been preaching most weeks for about 5 years now. I haven't come across a difficult passage that can't be understood.
Interesting.
I trust Scripture more now than I ever have. And I think we're keen to help our folks in deconstruction going through crisis of faith to reconstruct while trusting the Bible and while praying. So
you found that no matter how hard the passage is, you've been able to, through study, through prayer, through guidance of the Holy Spirit, to help people kind of
understand. Usually if something doesn't make sense and if Jesus or Paul have said something that seems mean or not fair, it's because you don't understand an English translation of an ancient word, or you don't understand the cultural moment that they were in.
Interesting.
And when you do your work, I engage my brain fully in the Scripture, and it's super satisfying.
So I like to ask you about the more difficult passage, but I know that'll rabbit trail us.
I taught Ananias and Sapphira a few weeks ago. That was one of the ones for me. So I was in a worship band at the time and kind of fell upwards into a music career.
Yeah.
I moved to America to be in a band, fell upwards into a music career. And I'd be playing these massive worship events as a bass player and reading Chris Hitchens' views on atheism with the curtain pulled in bed. And so it was very disinteresting, double agent, but I was just kind of straddling this professional Christian life, trying to figure out what on earth, you know, Ananias and Sapphira and the difficult passages meant.
So Acts 5, right?
It's in there.
Acts 5, and basically, that's the thing. I want to ask you more about that. Well, we're going to link to all this stuff because I do want people to go listen to your messages because you do put a lot of work into it, a lot of thought. And you guys team teach very similar to how we do at Crosspoint. You have a team of communicators at Church of the City that kind of help each other out too.
A brilliant group of folks. Great to be in the room with them.
It's amazing. So obviously you hinted at it earlier, but you don't sound like you're from around here.
No.
Part of what we love doing on this podcast is hearing people's stories, being a leader, influencer, pastor in our community. Just want to hear a little bit of your backstory, what got you to Nashville. So tell us a little bit where you're from, where you're born.
I was born on the 7th of the 7th, 1977.
Okay.
And I'm an Enneagram 7. I think I weighed 7 pounds 7.
No, come on.
No, it's all true.
Oh, wow.
So the intercessory prayer team used to freak out with those data points.
That's amazing.
So I was born in Australia, grew up in a rural country town. My dad, when I was very little, dad toured full time as a musician, and they had great success in Australia. But I really grew up in a town of 1,000 people. 2 hours inland from Brisbane, called Crow's Nest. Had 1,000 people in our little hometown. Went to a Methodist church, which Dad ended up becoming the pastor of. Went to a private school for high school in the nearby town, which was like 40 kilometers away. Met my wife there, and she started liking me back 5 years, 5 years after that. But yeah, I would say.
Did you like her? Were you into her immediately? Yeah.
Oh, the second I saw her.
Dude, brag on Mary for a little bit, because she is really one of the best people on the planet.
I don't know if it's possible for a 16-year-old boy to hear the voice of God as clearly as I did, that this she would be my wife. But I felt like I heard that, and it turns out I was right. I wouldn't recommend any other 16-year-old boy out there
trying to make that call.
That this is probably not your story.
Right.
But I remember just going, she's a great person. Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, we got married young, but we were 23. It took a little while for her to join that party.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we were both trained teachers. I taught high school. I never wanted to have a real job. Like, my plan was to be a rock star or a professional sportsman, and I wasn't quite good enough with the sport. So I thought being a phys ed teacher was a great bet both ways, you know, to be paid to do sport. Mary is a trained elementary teacher. She's now getting her master's in family counseling. So we're in the middle of that. We got 4 kids. We moved over to the States in 2006.
What brought you here?
A band I was in an Australian band, and we'd done really well over there. And most roads lead to Nashville when that's your story. So we did that. In that process, I won a green card. Which, you know, the way when you're an immigrant, when you get a visa, you're only allowed to do what your visa says you can do. So I was on a P1 visa, which was very limited.
Okay.
All I could do was play for the band that I was in. And we worked really hard to survive. Ended up winning this green card, and it opened up some other opportunities. So I ended up playing for different worship leaders in Nashville and added some other things.
Small startup by the name of Michael W. Smith. I'll say it because you won't, but that's actually the coolest thing that's ever happened to me musically is actually sending my bass guitar on the road with you around the world. That's the coolest thing that's ever happened to me.
I never thanked you for that, did I?
No, I think I thanked myself enough.
No, that was good.
Yeah, so you played bass.
Yeah, so I played with Michael for about 3 years, and I just knew deep down. Again, you know, the first half of my life, I just felt like I fell upwards and fell into some of these things accidentally. Like, sure. I don't think I could coach anybody to do what I did. It was just very.
It's not like follow my pattern on how
It wasn't like I was practicing 10 hours a day or anything like that. Really didn't deserve any of those things. And led a charmed first half of life. And since, you know, since hitting my early 30s, now I'm 42 now, I think I'm understanding just how complicated life can be, and that good things don't always happen to good people, and some real difficult, you know, adult lessons here since then. But I knew. I would look across the stage at the other guys and knew that their souls were expanding doing this.
Yeah.
And I loved it, but I just knew I was cut out for
something. So you would do a little bit of teaching while you're on the road. Like, you would do a little 5-10 minute thing with your band.
With the Australian band I did.
No. Did any part of you come alive doing that? Like, there's a gift here, or there's a calling?
There was a hint. Like, you know, I would always be the child sponsorship guy, and I get a kick out of, you know, sponsoring, you know, kids with whichever child sponsorship agency we were helping out at the time. Yeah, no, I had it. I knew that I didn't have a ton of reps in, but I enjoyed it and I liked it. I mean, that's the thing with spiritual gifts, right? Like, you can think about them at different levels.
Yeah.
Like, I think, you know, we all probably have a primary, secondary, and tertiary spiritual gift. And the way I understand it is, for me, your primary gift is one, when you do it, when you act in it, it helps people and it's really life-giving. Your secondary spiritual gifting, when you do it, it helps people and it's kind of a wash energy-wise.
Okay.
And we got this pesky tertiary gift, which is when you do it, it helps people and it's really exhausting.
But you don't love it.
Yeah, yeah. And so,
you're making me think. I don't know what mine are. I have to think about that. What are yours?
Well, I think with some reps in teaching is the one I love the best. I don't love prepping for sermons, but I do love how the scripture changes lives. So the end result is worth it. For me, the leadership part of leading a church of our scale is not natural for me.
Okay.
But I know I have I have some basic giftings that I can lead people, help cast some vision and push people in the one direction. But that's the exhausting stuff for me.
Right.
Like after the staff meeting Tuesdays or whatever that I've had to lead, that's when I'm tired.
Yeah.
I feel like I've done a okay job, but it's not.
But the days that you're writing or you get chance to preach, and after those days are like, you're pretty pumped.
Yeah, come alive. Yeah, so there was a clue to that back in over the music years. But I knew... I got pretty pragmatic. I went, I don't think this is really who I'm going to be till I'm 65. So I just picked a date. I thought 35 would be young enough to get a new job and be young enough for someone to believe I was agile enough to do something else. So ended up getting off the road at the age of 33.
Yeah.
Booked motivational speakers for a year.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, yeah. Wore a tie to work, and we had jeans Friday. You know, you could wear jeans to work on Friday. Be all cash.
What was God teaching you during that season, coming off the road, get into more corporate world? Like, what was going on inside you?
Well, one of the reasons I did it was to see more of the family.
Yes.
And it didn't end up turning out that way, which is, you know, a word of caution to musicians planning on getting off the road to see more of your family when you land a 9-to-5 job. It's a different rhythm. I learned to get very organized. Like when you're a booking agent, you have hundreds of things happening at a time, and so it really just kind of helped me become an adult very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And you know, it got beyond thinking through alternate changes on the bass guitar to how do I remember all this stuff and I have this whole thing.
Was that a challenging season for you?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know who I was when I stopped playing music, and you know, may remember I put on like close to 60 pounds over the course of a year.
We joke because we had a race to two. Am I allowed to say this?
Yeah, do it.
Okay, we had a race to 220. We were both wanting to get down to 220 pounds.
We're about 240.
Were we about the same weight?
We're about 240.
Yeah,
yeah.
And you did really well. I'm still in the race. You went towards 220. I went up to 325. See, I thought you said 320. And I went the wrong way.
Yeah. You're looking good.
Thank you.
Whatever you're doing. Congrats.
Yeah, you're my inspiration.
When I lost all the weight, I was in front of a church.
Yeah.
And everyone's got some free advice for you. Like, people think you're sick. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, yeah.
You don't have to go into the details. Plenty of free advice, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. A lot of free advice. I mean, it'll run the gamut. It'll be like, I've got people that come up to me and, like, think I'm legitimately ill.
Yeah.
And be like, hey, are you okay? Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, I'm just trying not to be quite as fat. And then, but there'll be other people that come up to me and be like, hey, I don't know how to say this, but looks like you maybe have lost a pound or two.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So everyone with the right heart, of course. I feel like I have a disclaimer with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, so. And it's tough because you're at that stage now where you've lost so much that it must be all you talk about on a Sunday. Because you teach every, 6 weeks or something?
Not that often, but yeah, it's enough like that space in between that you can notice a difference in between.
You look like your baby brother every time you go up.
This guy kind of looks like Drew.
Yeah.
But you're saying you just weren't healthy.
Yeah, I just think when you sit on a plane next to someone and tell them that you're a bass player, people are super interested.
Yeah.
You know, you've been a pastor, it's like no one wants to talk to you on a plane. So, you know, they're different things.
That's always the hardest part in a conversation when someone asks you, what do you do?
For me, the thing with weight was like when your body tells you something, you should believe it. And the body doesn't tend to lie. So whatever's going on in your body, it does make sense to pay attention. And for me, it was just like this deep sense that it wasn't enough. And it was a soul issue for me.
So it was hard leaving the road.
Surprisingly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big transition. For me, as a 7, the road trapped me in perpetual adolescence in a way. Like I got to lead large portions of my year just kind of hanging out. Having great times around the world, and you know, we have 4 kids, and
So as an Enneagram 7, you were able to go. That's the enthusiast for people that don't know. That's a person like it's a new city, it's a new event, it's just always something fun on the horizon.
No 2 days are the same,
right?
Even the concerts look a little different,
feels spontaneous a little bit. And if you do have a lot of responsibility at home, you can kind of escape it when you go on the road to be like, okay,
right?
Which probably there's some guilt and shame in there, like leaving Mary at home with the kids. At the time, you had the 3 boys,
or just the 2? Yeah, 3. Ellie came at the end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you're processing all that.
Right. Yeah. And I wasn't okay. So it took a bit. And actually, when we moved to Florida, which I guess we'll probably talk about soon here, that was a healing season.
So we met at a church in town. Mm-hmm. And I remember it was like my mission as worship pastor.
You were the worship pastor.
I was the worship pastor.
Do people know that about you?
Well, they do now.
Drew has forgotten more music than I've ever known.
I don't know if that's true. There's so many great, I mean, so many great musicians in the city. Right. It makes it really
fun.
They
don't need us, but no. You are good.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, I was leading worship at this church, and I remember the campus pastor, Brandon Porter, which I just saw him at the football field just this week for the first time. Love Brandon. So he gave me the message. He's like, there's a guy that comes to church here. He's at Spring Hill campus. At the time, we were actually in the Columbia High School auditorium.
Spring Hill High.
Nobody loved being there except for you because you could walk there from your house.
It was perfect.
You're the only one that actually liked being in that auditorium. My mission as a worship pastor was to find this guy named Matt Swalmon who plays bass on the road with Michael W. Smith and get him involved in the music. Oh, it would be so great if Matt would get involved. And everyone, I don't know if they were scared of you or what, but everyone just didn't realize that you were one really simple ask away. Like, it was like, hey man, would you ever play bass here on Sunday? You're like, yeah, of course. I'd love to. That was like, that's what I remember of it at least.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think we became friends pretty quick. I was new to town.
You started that small group?
The best small group I've ever been a part of was the one because you called it the non-obligation.
Switch off Church of the City people. We called it the non-church sanctioned small group.
Yeah. So people could feel like no pressure to come here. And yeah, it was, and I mean,
a bunch of creatives in that group.
It was a great group.
All little kids, same age.
Look forward to going to it. And our families became really close friends. Yeah. And I was leaving to go back to Florida. And I remember being at our church and talking to you on the porch and basically telling you like, hey, I'm coming for you. Like I'm going to bring you down to Florida. And you know, you were pretty resistant at first, not to the idea, but that's a big move to come down there.
Yeah. I always thought my next move would be back to Australia. So that was part of it. We get off the road. I'd learn to do something and be somewhat employable.
At what moment in that whole season did becoming a pastor become real for you?
Well, I mean, man, I tell people all the time, I wouldn't be a pastor if it wasn't for you. I think you need people. I guess there's people out there who go, yeah, I think I'm a pastor. I've never met anybody who kind of got there on their own. Hmm. So I always had people, you know, I think there's a spiritual gift mix and just a general gift mix that church people see that you may be able to be a pastor one day. So I'd heard it a little bit growing up. My dad was a pastor. I'm wired a lot like him.
Okay.
So I thought it may have been coming. But man, your encouragement to do that and to come on down was really like, and in the midst of that season where I was losing a bit of, in a season of deconstruction and also not really knowing who I was, it seemed like a good opportunity to press restart.
Yeah.
I also didn't mind getting out of Nashville either because all of our friends are in the same old rhythm of being on tour and, you know.
You're looking for a little change of scenery maybe.
Yeah, yeah. And the church was a block from the ocean.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that was a cool part. I mean, it really is it's a great church that we got to serve at down in Florida. I think what I saw in you is what probably everyone saw was that, you know, some people have pastor by title or by job or whatever, and then there's other people that just pastor people out of who they are. And you were already doing that. I mean, you were already pastoring, like, even with the small group, whatever, you were already pastoring people. And I was like, man, if we could get Matt to come down here. You started at the church that we both worked together. You started like in groups, discipleship, mm-hmm. community pastor, which I was like, man, and this is even before, at this point, you and I had never taught anything.
No.
We had
thoughts that we might be good at it one day.
Right.
It's kind of where we were.
Got a couple
We'd write our first sermons together and send them over.
We went to that, remember we went to a Preaching Rocket conference with Jeff Henderson, a good friend of ours now, but that we went together. Yeah. Just learning like, hey, I think there was a spark there of like, it's exactly what you said. It's helping people. Like
we'd critique each other's talks too. Remember that?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was always really, honestly, it's really helpful.
Right.
You know, and I still feel like you're that guy for me. I remember the first time I was going to speak at Crosspoint. Do you remember this phone call? I called you.
What did I say?
I said, Smalls, they asked me to speak at Crosspoint. And again, nobody here knew that I'd ever done that before. And I was scared to death to do it. And I said, I don't know, man. I don't know if I'm going to do it or not. And you just have a way about you where you can say things that maybe not anyone else can say, but you get away with it. You just said, well, of course you're going to do it. You're going to do it. You're going to hate every minute of it. And then it's going to be done. And you're going to be really glad that you did it. And you like, basically that was the end of the conversation. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. I guess I'll do it. And it was true. It was like all leading up to it. I was so nervous. And afterwards I was like, I was so glad I did that. And that was one of the only times
I leaked your preaching tape, a video to Ketrick is what happened.
Really?
I made it happen. Like I'm going to take all the credit. But yeah, I gave Ketrick.
Interesting.
Yeah, and he.
I'm not sure I knew that.
Yeah, yeah, we were sharing office space.
Ketrick leads our the team Dream Center in town, and you guys were sharing office space at Church City Ketrick.
I said, you know, Drew can preach, man, and I sent it to him.
That's crazy.
I don't want to take all the credit. Just some. Just some.
Oh, man. There's a lot of people mad at you for that very thing. So don't think that's a good thing for everyone. Wow, that's interesting. So, yeah, so I recruited you to Florida to come. Let's come work together. And we got a few months in. And this is the part of the story I want to talk about. I knew Kevin was going to talk about forgiveness on Sunday. And I reached out to you, and I was like, man, because we haven't really talked about this, but there was a set of circumstances that happened in Florida that caused a riff in our friendship and our relationship. And I'll say, I've told people this before, you really fought for our friendship in a lot of ways. And I think it's kind of sealed the fact that, like, you know, you'll be one of my best friends forever because of that. It really made a difference in my life in a big way. Like, hey, here's a guy that I wounded. I did something that hurt him. And what you did in walking the process of forgiveness and reconciliation and everything is so rare and taught me so much. And you were the much, much bigger person in this scenario. And I don't really want to go into all the details of it. Let's just say I made some decisions that were hurtful. They were hurtful decisions, and I brought you down. That caused us to not be working together anymore. But living in the same town, working at different churches, and it was weird. It got weird. And there's a lot. I mean, I spoke a couple weeks ago on shame here. There's a lot that I've had to own from that, a lot of decisions I made. But more than anything, you extended forgiveness. And I remember you sent me an email. So we go through this whole thing, and things were weird between some churches.
We lived three blocks away from each other, right?
Pretty much. Couldn't avoid each other. I mean, really, we were living like right in the same neighborhood, same area. And then we found ourselves in like a relational, what would you call it? Just a disconnect, a divide, just kind of on opposite sides of a really, not good situation. And again, we're both sevens, which means we're not great at feeling pain. We're not great at looking back. We're not great at digging into the past. Even this conversation for us is like probably difficult. But I was just trying to move on. And do you remember much about that? Because honestly, I don't remember tons. I think I was reaching out to you because we'd still play basketball together and stuff. And what I actually, when I was thinking about interviewing you for this, I actually went back and I found the email you sent me. And it actually hit me a little harder probably this time than even before because I was just in the fog.
Well, so what I do know about myself in that era was I wouldn't have self-described as emotionally healthy. I may have thought it at the time, but I would definitely look back as not the best version of me. Was it like, how hurtful was that? Was it a hurtful email?
When I received it, yeah, it was.
Like accusations?
There were some things in the email that I felt like you didn't have full context.
Right.
Like you were accusing me of some things. I was like, oh man, that's not the full story. What I
felt, my version of it was different.
Right. Because we hadn't really had a chance to talk about everything. Right. So I was like, oh man, there's some things here that maybe he doesn't have a clear picture of. But more than that, I mean, it was like you exposed to me like how wounded you were. I think I was telling myself a different story. I think I had maybe taken on some victim mentality.
Right.
And so when I read it for the first time, I was like, I really, someone I really care about, I've wounded.
I guess the 40,000 foot view explanation from my end was that, you know, we moved down there to work with you. It wasn't really the church that recruited me.
Right.
You know, it was you. And so that was like, I guess I just imagined it was going to be, you know.
And my parents were like family and
yeah, all that stuff. How long were we uncomfortable around each other for? Like, was it a year?
I'm still relatively uncomfortable around you.
No, I get it.
This is what we do when things get serious. We start making jokes.
Hey, you got to do your tension. Work, man. Don't release the pressure.
That was a diversion.
Yeah. It was about a year probably.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I've never told you this before. But when I found out that you were moving back up here, it was one of the biggest reliefs.
Right.
Because I always hated living in the same city of Florida and us not working together.
Right.
That never was comfortable while you're there. I was like, man, and I didn't want you to leave as a friend. But when I heard you were coming back here, I was like, oh, it almost was like a, okay, like at least it's not in my face every day.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, I get it. I guess I was wounded by it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the truth is probably at that phase of my spiritual journey, I was more interested in moving out of state to hang out with a mate than to follow Jesus obediently. Like, oh, if I'm going to be totally, yeah, because I was coming out of a season of deconstruction where it was like, I was not the best version of myself by any means. So I think it was just one of those ones where you put your trust in someone rather than God. It usually does go squirrely, even if that's your wife or
yep.
friends or family or anything. You know, part of my challenge with this whole thing is it's like my memory is not clear, and right. I don't know whether it is because that's what sevens do, and we just block out the pain
yeah.
by just not really processing with it. But I do remember we went through a process. I remember one of the, you know, I've since learned some important things about forgiveness that I think we fell into as okay. we went through this. So like Ronald Rollheiser is one of my favorite authors. In his book Sacred Fire, he describes like at least four stages that people need to address in forgiveness. And I think I got here. I think if I had read something, I didn't read my way through this. I felt my way
yeah.
through it and kind of acted, you know, out of pain.
Yeah.
But eventually we got there. And he would say like the four stages of forgiveness is, first of all, you've got to forgive someone who's hurt you, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and I feel like I got there early on. Like I was just like, okay, I get this. Like I understand the decisions that were made. I was thinking about this on the drive over. I don't think any of us even necessarily acted outside of the will of God. Like I wouldn't even know that for sure.
Right.
I felt like what happened probably was meant to happen, and you and I were just emotionally not there.
Sure.
Our EQs probably weren't, you know, emotional intelligence maybe wasn't there to just handle it in a godly way.
Right.
We were in our early 30s, like you're in your early 30s, right?
Yeah.
Like we still had some.
Yeah. And yeah. Well said.
Yeah. So forgive those who hurt you, you know, releasing someone from the moral debt. And I felt like I did that early on, but the thing was it didn't really feel any better. And that was the confusing bit for me. Mm-hmm. You know, the deal with forgiveness is it's usually like you're releasing yourself from this debt. Basically, forgiveness is not needing anyone to pay you back. So just say in this situation, you hurt me. Real forgiveness is the art of me releasing you from me
needing to do anything.
Yeah,
for
or for you needing to feel pain for this
gotcha.
Anymore, right? So I did that, but it didn't even necessarily set me free because we still, you know, we try to do stuff and it was just awkward. You know, your church, of course, was a raging success in the midst of all that, which from my end, that was hard. That was hard
to watch.
Yeah, similar to the point you made before. But, you know, Rollheiser would say step one is really the only step that Christians know about, and that you've got to forgive the moral debt of someone. Mm-hmm. You know, so you go, however you do it, I wrote you an email. I think it finished with, I forgive you.
Yeah.
I'm scared of seeing you at Walmart or something like that, right?
Right. I'm tired of
walking around Walmart.
Yeah.
And not.
Well, I might have said this already. I can't remember, but like I found the email. Like I right. read it recently.
Right.
And I think I might have just said it a minute ago, but it was hard to read the second time. It was like, I couldn't believe I found it, first of all.
The conclusion was, I forgave you, right?
Right.
Via email.
Right.
So there was this kind of cathartic moment to that. And I felt like my cistern was cleaned a little bit.
Right.
But it was still like, I'd think about you a lot and it would be painful. And so what I did was I only went to stage one. Rollheiser would go, then you then need to forgive your own sins in this situation.
Hmm.
So then I probably needed to do the work of like, man, do you seriously move in a state to work with some dude, you know, like was that it? Is that a sin? Like what did I own in this?
Okay.
How was I acting immaturely throughout this? Because again, I don't think anyone really, I think the way that story played out was probably how it was meant to go.
Both churches are doing phenomenal
yeah,
with it.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent.
Everything's going
yeah,
great.
We did, we just didn't handle it well interpersonally.
Yeah.
Like we probably could have stayed mates the whole way through it.
Yeah.
Then Rollheiser would say, in many situations, you just need to forgive life for being unfair.
Hmm.
That just sometimes good things don't happen
is this
to
it
good
is
people.
And
yeah, you know, the older I get, I'm realizing that the world doesn't occupy on a simple moral algorithm. Bad things happen to good people. And on this side of eternity, that is how this is going to be. And so there's a part of it with forgiveness where you just got to go, you know what? I moved in a state that didn't work out. That's hard.
Yeah, you want a reason for
it. It's almost like Rollheiser's almost arguing and, you know, don't tweet this, but you've almost got to forgive the universe. You know, it's just like, man, we are trapped in this interesting moment between the resurrection of Jesus and the second coming, where the kingdom of God is a now but not yet, not fully yet scenario, where every now and then we feel peace and joy, but it's not going to be the dominant narrative. The sad things, I believe, are becoming progressively less true, but we're not there yet. So forgive kind of the universe for being unfair, and then he would say, then forgive God for not rescuing you from this. So you do the work of like, you know, God, you're my dad. I had this idea of you. Now, most of us, we've made, before we deconstruct the first time, we've made God out to be in the image of a best version of ourselves and a mixture of our parenting's, of our parents' best and worst parenting behaviors.
Sure.
So we have a really small image of God there for a while. And I was definitely there. And my image of God would have led me to believe that God should never have done anything that would allow me to make my family vulnerable or cause me pain. And that's just not entirely true. It was the great lesson. It was a great healing season for me. I needed to be there for all that. So he would say there's four stages.
Yeah, run through those four again real quick. So that's so
step one, forgive those who hurt you,
okay,
which is pretty much all we do as Christians. Like that's like, that's the home run.
Right.
I forgive you, you know. And we wonder why we're miserable and still scared of running into a guy at Walmart, you know, because we're not free from it yet. Then he would say, so step one, forgive those who hurt you. Step two, forgive your own sins. So do a searching and fearless moral inventory and look at what's going on in your own heart. Mm-hmm. You know, what was I doing to make things worse? Obviously, none of us are ever guilt-free in conflict.
Yeah.
Step three, forgive life for being unfair. And step four, forgive God for not rescuing you, saving you in the way that you think he should have, which in my world was like, just save me from pain, man. Like your job is to protect me like I'm a 2-year-old and save me.
Where were you at, God, on that?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
What, man, that is so powerful. That is so good. So in your processing, in your journey, what made you send that email? So like, why wasn't just, well, screw that guy. Like he's, you know, what, do you know what I mean?
If I didn't have kids, I probably wouldn't have sent the email.
Okay.
The way I process things a lot at that age was, okay, I am living 3 blocks from one of my favorite humans in the planet, and I'm not talking to him right now.
Right.
Is this the example I want Isaac to grow up with his dad, with these series of fractured friendships over something that's even explainable, somewhat logical, and I'm not doing anything about it because I'm hurt? And so for me, I don't think if I had the constraint of kids,
that was a driver.
Yeah. I was like, man, do I want to raise them to be this person who harbors grudges? And the answer was no. So eventually I was becoming a person I didn't want to be. I was also kind of re-emerging into this joyful relationship with Jesus.
At the same time.
Yeah. And I'm just like, I don't, you know, it was the one thing. It was always the thing for me. Like you'd receive communion and I'd be always forgiving you and trying to feel better about it. And I was just tired of it.
Yeah, it's got fatigue.
Yeah.
What if I would have... So I got that email and I was blown away. I was like, oh, man. Mm-hmm. And you were really articulate in the email. I mean, I thought you were really fair in the email. I don't feel like you vented in the email. I thought you offered a lot of grace and a lot of forgiveness. I feel like you're bringing in my... Knowing me, there's a good chance I was trying to move on without addressing things that I had caused some hurt. And probably, and I'm now speaking for you, there probably was a sense for you of like, hey, I think Drew doesn't realize what the implications of some of the decisions he made, because I probably was just moving on happy-go-lucky. Hey, man, let's play basketball. And almost you needed to like pause before we continued on in our friendship to say, hey, no, there's some things here that maybe you're not aware of that you need to own. You wouldn't say it that way, but I felt there was almost like in the email, I was like, hey, I'm not ready to move on yet because there's some things here that I don't know if you were seeking an apology for them, like, or it was more of an awareness thing. Again, the email was written, it was a really classy email, really well. I didn't feel attacked at all. I felt when I read it again, the emotions came back like, wow, I didn't realize that he was feeling this. So what if I would have responded poorly?
I don't know. I don't think you did. You know, for me,
But would you have just had to like put it away at that point? Or I mean, because I'm thinking about people that are offering forgiveness to people.
I think our situation's different because I probably knew you wouldn't.
Gotcha.
You know, like there would have been an added, I didn't feel there was a ton of, I felt like nothing much could go wrong with sending that email. Like we're not hanging out anyway.
Right.
You know?
You got nothing to lose at this point.
I think if you were a different type of person and, you know, deep down I always trusted your heart.
Yeah.
So,
I remember responding back and saying, hey, man, we got to talk. Like, right. I didn't even respond to email. And then we had just...
Went to that Mexican restaurant.
We had the weirdest, chips and salsa I've ever had in my life. Us both trying not to cry.
Rollheiser doesn't talk about this in his list of four things. But one thing that really helped me, and it didn't feel like it did at the time, was you moved house for the 17th time in our friendship. And we had to move the red piano again. I saw you... I think you posted online about it. I doubt you would have invited me over there to lift stuff, but I came... Yeah. And it was like you and all the great new members of your church and this stuff. And I remember feeling really self-righteous while I was doing it. Like I'm going, I'm the best Christian in this entire state.
How many times did you move that red piano, do you
think?
Too
many. And you don't have it anymore.
No, I got rid of it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a sum zero game, the old red piano.
And I think the last time you moved, I happened to be out of town. I couldn't help.
That's great. That's great.
It's classic.
It was just an upright. So.
Yeah, it wasn't that big deal.
For me, just physically doing something to say that I love you, mm-hmm. I think while I was, because I left it going, man, that was just a waste of time. Like I just spent my whole time feeling really self-righteous and almost felt worse afterwards. Like I'd just eaten a bunch of candy at a kid's party or something like that.
Right.
I kind of had that kind of sick feeling to
right.
it. But I think, you know, this is really unsatisfying psychology that people are uncovering, but people are really discovering that sometimes you just got to fake it till you make it. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know what category of theology that is. But for me, it felt like I had to do the next right thing. Yeah. You needed help because obviously you're incapable of moving a red piano on your own.
Yep.
You know, I think sometimes all you can do is the next right thing. And I would not say I went into that with a pure heart at all. Yet it just kind of started pushing things in the right direction. It's first time back in the house, you know, all those kind of things. It kind of, sometimes when you're re-entering into a relationship with someone, you've got to get some difficult first things.
Was the red piano move before our conversation, before the email?
No,
can you remember?
No, I think it was afterwards. Yeah.
So even after our conversation, we had chips and salsa, talked about it. You still didn't feel an immediate release. It still wasn't like, hey, we're good now. It was like there was still some little hangover, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the secret with forgiveness is you've kind of got to take some hits yourself. It's sort of like there's some poison that, you know, if we're not, you know, so for me, I was really worried about the generational implications of me not being able to forgive someone that I actually like mm-hmm. and love at the same time. You know, and Jesus' example always when he was forgiven people was he would transform it and not transmit it. Now, I didn't have this language at the time, but I think the job of the Christian regarding forgiveness and sin, because there's, you know, you don't have to read the Bible super carefully to know or to look at anybody's genogram, which is like a study of people's family back three generations, mm-hmm. to know that there are certain sins in your family that just keep getting passed from generation. So if your dad was a philanderer and your grandpa was a philanderer, you better pay attention,
gotcha,
you know, when you first get married, right? So I think part of our, you know, my job as a dad regarding forgiveness is to act like a water purifier, some would use, like Jesus took hatred, held it and transformed it and gave back love, which is, you know, that's the stuff of spiritual heroes right there. Hmm. I don't think I got to any of this standard. Jesus took jealousy, held it, gave it back as affirmation. Jesus took resentment, held it, transformed it, gave it back as compassion. And ultimately with Jesus, he took murder, held it, transformed it, and gave it back as forgiveness. And I think that's the Christian design. Like something has to happen inside of us where we just take this dirty water and rather than passing it on. Because, you know, what happened was when you and I weren't okay, it would actually just spill out into those that I love the most. While it wasn't dealt with, Mary did not have a great husband and my kids were kind of the pain when you're not processing it, just kind of spills out over a bunch of people who don't deserve it and certain things would trigger you and all that stuff.
So it was a process.
Right.
You had to get, I mean...
yeah, it's not easy. Yeah, and I would definitely say saying the words "you're forgiven" was a starting, like, was a first step of a journey,
not a finished product at
yeah.
the point.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Usually these things take time.
Yeah.
Like I think we would be spiritually unwise to lead people in that. Like, it's just going to be.
Right.
Your job, right. I think it's actually be a spiritually dangerous thing to say, is that your job is to forgive people and forget about it.
Yeah.
I think we got to be very careful.
Do you remember the first time it didn't feel weird?
Yeah. To close off that last point.
Yeah.
Like, if you had an opportunity for move interstate with you again to do ministry, like, I'd be unwise to not weigh it all up. Do you know what I mean? Like, even though we're cool, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
so it's not about just like forgiving
and
forgetting.
So just because you brought that up, I'll pause on my other question for a minute. So let me ask this, and this is a hard question to ask, but we're already here. Having been through that situation with me,
yeah.
Would you say our friendship, our relationship is stronger, worse, scarred? Where's the trust? Because what you just said is wise, right? So if Drew recruits me to move over here again, what I'm hearing you say, it's not necessarily a hard no, but it's like I've got some history now that I need to weigh this out. So how has our friendship relationship, has it been damaged? Is it damaged? Is it better? Is it stronger? We know each other better. Like, how would you?
I mean, to me, it seems better and stronger. I mean, we don't.
Oh, and I wasn't fishing for that, by the way.
No.
I know that's a hard question.
No, I know. I mean, neither of us have enough spare time to be actual friends.
More in theory.
Like, life's pretty full and we're raising kids and we have a great theoretical friendship. It's not like we're hanging out, you know, every Thursday or something like it.
Like, I'd like to, though, if you're open to it.
Sure. But, you know, sadly, my dance card's really full. But, you know, it's the truth, right? So part of it is, like, the reality of right now is that's not really a season either of us are in for about another 10 years before you just get to hang out with your mates.
Yeah, exactly.
Whenever you want.
Is that when our kids graduate high school?
Yeah, I think Ellie probably. I think if I've got one at home,
could hang out.
I could do some top golf on a Tuesday, maybe.
I look forward to that.
About the year 2029.
I'll put it on my calendar. I said it.
Yeah. I think we've done some good work. Like, I mean, the truth is we were really good friends beforehand.
Yeah.
Like, we knew each other's character. We had to transcend a situation. You know, one of the other things to consider when working through conflict with someone is you've got to find a way to transcend it at a certain point. Transcend and include is really helpful language. So it's sort of like, okay, this thing happened. How can I kind of look at this as a bit of an outsider?
Okay. Like, get outside of yourself.
Yeah,
a little bit.
But include you in doing it. Because it's one thing to transcend a thing and just kind of stonewall somebody. You know, transcend and include, we don't have time to go into it. It's really helpful language. Transcend and include the other person.
I just said it in an American accent so people understand.
Yes, transcend and include.
Oh, go on.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly how you sound.
Oh, geez. Yeah, this is terrible. I should not be hosting a podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so there's a part of it where sometimes you need time. I think with forgiveness, it's never going to be instant.
Uh-huh.
And I think if you're expecting that, you're going to be disappointed.
Right.
Because that would be a sign of the future kingdom of God being here already, where sad things just don't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you got to be wise when someone hurts you.
I mean,
the interesting thing with forgiveness that I've only come across recently as a thought is just because we forgive someone doesn't mean God has. And that's a bit of a mind-blowing insight for me. Like, pastorally, when I'll teach about forgiveness, I'll have a handful of people who come up to me and say, listen, my mum abused me. I'm scared if I forgive her that that's just letting her off the hook. And I never really knew how to handle that conversation because the greatest fear is one of the unfair things about grace is, well, we are the great recipients of it. At a certain point, we want to hold people accountable for their bad behavior.
Talk to them. Talk to people listening right now or watching on YouTube as a pastor. So I would imagine there's a lot of people that feel that way, Matt, where they're saying, I want to forgive you, but I don't necessarily want to let you off the hook for what you've done to me.
I read a story a while ago, like in South Africa, at the end of apartheid. The nation of South Africa did something very brave. They attempted a process of restorative justice. And it was a bit flawed, but people wildly considered it was a success. And what they did was they established this thing called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was sort of like a court a court-like restorative justice body. They assemble witnesses and victims of gross human rights violations, and people were invited to tell their stories and their experiences. And some were selected for public hearings. And what would happen is the perpetrators of violence could give a testimony and they could request amnesty for how they acted under the laws of apartheid. So what they did back then wasn't breaking the rules, but obviously it was breaking some serious moral codes. Now, while seeking amnesty under the terms of this South African Truth and Reconciliation process, one of the attackers apologized for his actions to this lady, Doy Ackerman, who responded. So asked to be forgiven. And she said this: "I want you to know that I forgive you unconditionally. I do that because I am a Christian. I can forgive you for the hurt you have caused me, but I cannot forgive you the sin that you have done."
Wow.
Only God can forgive you for that. That's so powerful. It's forgiving you for the hurt.
Yeah.
And the sin is not my decision
right.
to be made. I can't speak into that.
Right.
So what she's doing is she's uncoupling herself
sure.
from whatever happened.
So you're saying you can balance forgiveness and justice in the same, like there's a tension there that you can yeah. balance. It's not saying it's one and the same.
Yeah, and I'm not even convinced. And this is, and I'm still got a lot of thinking to do on this one, but I'm not convinced just because I forgive somebody. Mm-hmm. It actually will set me free if I do that. It will untether me from that moment.
You're not convinced it will, or
I'm not convinced that when I forgive someone, I'm convinced that that helps me untether myself from that moment, and I can move on,
yeah,
and mature in my life. What's unclear to me is whether I don't think I have the ability to forgive someone of their sins. So I think it's an right. interesting pastoral angle with people right. to say, just because you're forgiven your mum who did unthinkable things to you, I'm not. This has nothing to do with, like, right. that's not giving God the okay to forgive them.
No, but that holds up scripturally, because that is the whole point of forgiveness, that it's really is less about the other person and more about the freedom that you
right.
need to
right.
discover and find.
Yeah,
that holds up.
Yeah, and justice is for God's.
Yeah,
that to work through.
That's extremely powerful. What encouragement would you give to people who are wrestling through right now, whether they're resisting giving forgiveness, maybe that's a situation like that. And I mean, you just did talk about it, but you deal with this a lot as a pastor.
I think we got a choice to make with forgiveness. When we are young, our main problems are connected to lust. And as you age, your primary temptation is anger because you've realized you've been hurt so much. And what happens is your spiritual psychological vocabulary slims down to very few concepts that are important. Forgiveness is one of those. Pastorally, I will tell you that when you hang out with 80-year-olds, you either meet, I don't know many moderate 80-year-olds who aren't either the best humans on the planet.
Yeah.
Or like they
or grouchy
yeah. get off my grass type of personhood. And I think as we age, if we don't get forgiveness under control, it sends us down one of those two paths. They lead to serious different destinations.
Yeah.
Some old people laugh easily, enjoy life, they're warm, and some are just grouchy. And I think the great spiritual imperative is whether we die old with a soft heart or not.
Mm.
And if you don't forgive, that option isn't on the table. And it'll actually really impact the back end of your life. So we got to learn how to forgive, or else it's not possible to die with a soft heart.
Yeah. That's so good, man. Wow. I'm like soaking in. I'm learning a lot just from listening to this. It's so powerful, and I feel like we could keep going, but I want to just kind of leave it there, because I think that's the thought that we need to hear and need to focus on. And and I would just encourage people listening that are struggling with this, I'd love to, if you want to just even send an email to anythingspossible@crosspoint.tv, if you've got a question about forgiveness, I'll forward it to Matt. he can get you the answer. I'm sure they can
find you online.
Which
would be the icing on our friendship.
Yeah, exactly.
More work. Thank you.
More work for Smalls. But we conclude all of our podcasts, and you can answer this question in the light of this conversation, or it's just a free pass. You can answer however mm-hmm. you want. But we call it Anything's Possible podcast for a reason, because we do believe that with Jesus, anything is possible. We're believing for some big things for people's lives, also for our city and our churches. But if I were to ask you that question, if anything truly was possible, what are some of the things you're dreaming about for you or for your family or city or church?
Yeah. I mean, my big dream is that we would actively see the kingdom of God invading our neighborhood. And you know, when the kingdom of God is invading a space because of peace and justice and joy, there's a lot of painful stories of kids in our neighborhood that, you know, if I could believe for anything, that our church and our churches would be unified in serving the at-risk kids in our city, because there's some painful stories going on, and that would be my great hope, that that the loneliness and the fear experienced by kids would be a thing of the past under our kind of spiritual leadership of this area.
Yeah. What are ways we can get, I know you're doing some things, get involved, and I didn't plan to ask you this, but what are some ways that we could get involved in that?
The data point for me is that if a kid isn't reading by the third grade, that is the stat that people who build prisons choose how many prisons they need to build in about 20 years time. So I would say mentoring kids is really important. And if you're looking for something, like if you're going, I really want to make a difference, and this is a long-term play, mm-hmm. I would get involved in some kind of program that's teaching a third grader how to read, and it will make a disproportionate difference.
That's amazing. Well, man, thank you so much for having this conversation, some dropping wisdom. Hey, let's make a deal. Let's never talk about this again. All right,
please.
Let's just go play ping pong and we'll be done, move on. All right, man. I appreciate you, man. Thanks for your leadership in our community. Proud of you, man.
Thank you.